Eat, Drink, Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat, drink, indie. Welcome to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. You know, sometimes I just can't resist reaching into the Eat, Drink, Indie archives and revisiting some interviews from the past year. And that's just what we've done for this week's episode. So this week we are talking and cooking with Chef Tom England of Ivy Tech Community College as part of our Recipe Box project. We'll also check in again with Suzanne Krowiak of Indie Food Swappers. We talked with her on the group's 5th anniversary last summer, and they have another swap coming up next week. Last spring, we talked with Chef Tyler Harold of Patashew Inc.'s Public Greens restaurant in Broad Ripple about a chef's seasonal anticipation of spring produce. And because we've had so much of that warm weather lately, we'll be looking ahead to barbecue season with restaurateur and competitive barbecue champ Jeff Yater of Squealer's Barbecue. And we'll be getting a few tips as well. So stay with us for more here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, and we need to do a little cooking today. Because I think we could all use a little home cooking, a little comfort, don't you think? The Recipe Box Project here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio aims to do just that, to take a look at family recipes, cook them here with you, and enjoy and celebrate the food that makes us feel good, that brings us together, that brings back memories. I was cooking recently with Chef Tom England of Ivy Tech Community College for the very first installment of the Recipe Box Project, and the memories were one of the best parts. In this case, the memories of cooking with Mom. Memories are in the details, you know? How something looked, or tasted, or smelled. For our first Recipe Box Project dish, we were making something that Chef Tom called Popeye. At its heart, it's chicken and noodles. We're still not sure where the name Popeye comes from. It's not from the cartoon character. It could be a variation on pot pie, we decided. And you can indeed find references online to similar dishes called Popeye. But the dish is way more than a name. It's something that can evoke memories about what it tasted like, what it smelled like, even how the kitchen looked and felt. But it's important, I think, to keep these family recipes alive, you know, to take them out of the recipe box and actually make them. And when you do that, you learn something. It's kind of a connection in a way, making something that someone else has made, doing something that they've done. And when it's a family recipe, you know that it's a recipe that's doable, even if it might sound a little intimidating, like the noodles that Chef Tom is making. Even though making homemade noodles might sound challenging, as it turned out, it's a pretty basic recipe. But even in the easiest recipes, there are still ways to make it your own. As Tom found out when he asked his mother about her recipe. I really do love the fact that here was a family recipe, something that his mom had made for him his whole life, an old-fashioned, homey dish that's simple and hearty and heartwarming, and yet there's a secret ingredient. How fun is that? And now he knows. That's how recipes stay alive. I'm sure that the addition of poultry seasoning to the noodles will be added onto the recipe card or jotted down as a note. And just like that, he's come a little closer to recreating a memory. So food and cooking and recipes are pretty powerful stuff. It's interesting to think about that when I look at all the recipes spilling out of my own mom's recipe boxes. Those boxes were the inspiration for the whole Recipe Box Project idea. The notion that wouldn't it be interesting to cook with people and talk with them while they made one of their family recipes. And as we found out, as we cooked and talked, there was a lot more going on with that pot of chicken and noodles than just a hearty home-cooked meal. So that's what the Recipe Box Project is all about. The power that we all have to find these old recipes and see what they conjure up. Now, not all old recipes are winners. If you follow along with my food adventures on Facebook, you might see some retro recipes that haven't stood the test of time. I'm thinking here of a ham and banana thing that really didn't work. But when the really well-loved recipes do work, well, there's just something special that happens. You get the taste right, and you remember. You remember the person who cooked it for you, or the look of the kitchen, or who was there. And sometimes it's something as simple as the smell of what's cooking. So I hope that's what we can do with the Recipe Box Project here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. I hope we can try some family recipes, figure a few things out, and just cook. Because it isn't complicated, it doesn't have to be fancy. You don't need special ingredients to have a special recipe. I think it mostly comes down to just doing it and being willing to give it a try. So we'll be doing more cooking here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. And you can look for more about our Recipe Box Project segments on eatdrinkindie.com. The first Indie Food Swappers event of 2017 is coming up next week, and I love efforts like that, things that encourage people to cook or can or bake or even grow. It's fun to see the variety of food do-it-yourself ideas that people bring to a local food swap event. And if you've never been to a food swap, well, it's sort of like a traditional cookie exchange, only not just with cookies. At an Indie Food Swappers event, you might see cookies, true, but you'll also find jams and pickles and breads and dips and drinks and, well, you never know what all will be there. And the idea is then for participants to swap their bread or pickles for someone else's cookies or jams. Indie Food Swappers founder Suzanne Krowiak explains how it all works.
Well, a food swap is remarkably like its name in that a group of people show up and we swap food. We swap things we like to make. The only guidelines are that it's either homemade, homegrown, or foraged. But foraging is not a wild pastime. And some people do it in Indianapolis, but we haven't really seen that at our food swaps. Mostly what we see are people who have made things themselves, anything from, you know, pickles, jams, to breads, their favorite cookie recipe, teas, sourdough starters. Honestly, from Chex Mix to you name it, and it's probably been at one of our food swaps.
I think that's interesting, because I came to the very first one, yes. And I had chocolate chip cookies, but I felt like, well, you know, this is more than a cookie exchange, but that might be an idea that people might understand. You know how you bring cookies to a cookie exchange and you go home with something. And the food swap is like kind of like that, but so much more.
It's exactly like that. And that you bring, and also the way cookie swaps traditionally work is you take home what you bring. So if you bring, you know, 6 dozen cookies, you leave with 6 dozen cookies, but different ones than the ones you made yourself. And that's also the way the food swap works. So it's a one-to-one swap and you take home what you bring. So if you go, you know, one of the early food swaps, a woman, she just brought a pie. She brought one pie, and she left with something. Now, I think she probably wouldn't do that. We have had other people who do that, and they will maybe make a pie, and they'll package 3 really good slices of pie and swap that so they can break it up and get more for their pie buck, so to speak. So it is that where you go and you swap what you have. So one of the most frequently asked questions I have is, well, how much do I bring to a food swap? And my answer really is just to tell them, well, it's a one-to-one swap, so you'll bring whatever you want to take home. And so people generally bring anywhere from 6 things to swap up to maybe 12 or 18 or more. I would say the average is between 8 and 10. And by that I mean not 8 to 10 different things, although certainly you can do that. But let's say you are making cookies and that's what you're swapping. You would package up your cookies, maybe 4 cookies in a bag or some sort of, some people put them in Ziplocs, some people get very creative where it looks like it could be sold in a really high-end food, the artisan shop. So then you would take maybe 8 to 10 packages of cookies, and that's what you would swap.
Tell me how that works, how you get to actually swap your thing for somebody else's.
So what we do is everybody who arrives, and we do our swaps at City Market in downtown Indianapolis, and everybody gets a little table, and they set up what they brought. It is a ticketed event, so you can't just show up and participate. We have a limited, we cap it at 35 people. Generally, the tickets become available 2.5 to 3 weeks before the swap and tend to go quickly. And so you have to have a ticket to participate. So you come with your ticket and with your items, set up on a table, a small table, and then everybody gets what's called a bid sheet. And it's not a silent auction, but that's the imagery I use often to explain it to people, where it's a sheet of paper. So everybody sets everything up. They set out their, what we call bid sheets, this one piece of paper. And then everybody walks around and takes a look at what else is available, what's interesting to them. And so then what you do is, so if I go and I try someone's shortbread cookies and I'm the one who brought some jars of jam, then I would write down, let's say, Jolene, you brought your, if I recall, salted chocolate chip cookies, which were very good. And I want to trade my jar of, ground cherry jam for a package of your cookies. Then I would write my name on your bid sheet. And I would write what I'm offering to swap. So I would write my name, Suzanne, ground cherry jam. So we spend, 20 minutes to half an hour doing this, where people are walking around, seeing what's available, and then writing down their name on these bid sheets for things that they're interested in swapping. And then after everybody's had a chance to look and see who's interested in their items, we literally almost have a signal, ladies and gentlemen, start your swapping. And then it's difficult to describe if you're not there, and everyone just kind of picks up their things and walks around and swaps. And so as I said, the bid sheets are really a starting point. So just because someone's written their name down, it may be that, on your way to them, other people stopped you and that looked great. And so it's what I tell people is there may be people that don't want to swap with you. Maybe they have, they don't like chocolate, so they're not interested in the salted chocolate cookies. But so maybe, you maybe don't like ground cherry jam. So I wanted your cookies, but you're not so interested in my jam. So I just like, oh, that's cool. There's someone behind you who has something equally delicious. So I try to tell people not to take it personally, because you aren't obligated to swap with people. It is a barter. It's like, do you like what I have? Great. I like what you have. Let's trade. So one thing I do is really encourage people to not take it personally. If someone doesn't want to swap, it could be a food allergy, food sensitivity, just a food, whatever. Chocolate isn't their thing. Nuts aren't their thing. But people always leave happy.
We've been talking with Indie Food Swappers founder Suzanne Krowiak. For more information on upcoming swaps, go to indiefoodswappers.com or look for it on Facebook. Of doing a show like Eat, Drink, Indie Radio are the great stories we get to hear. Stories of how people had an idea, developed it, and brought their product or farm or food out into the world to share it with the community. One of my favorites is the story of Gwendolyn Rogers and her cake bake shop. The little bake shop in Broad Ripple has been around now for more than 2 years, and it just continues to grow in popularity. In fact, you can expect another location soon, I'm sure. And of course, you can see her cakes and other items on a few food TV shows and even in the movies. And the movie part of it all is fascinating, too, And you can check out the celeb photos on the walls of her Broad Ripple shop while waiting for your slice of cake or glass of champagne. But owner Gwendolyn Rogers tells us how the cake bake shop came about and how the first 2 years have been.
2 years. Long, exhausting, hard, a ton of work. I never sleep. I've aged 20 years in two. But at the same time, it's been an incredible journey. And I have an amazing staff of 61 people now. When I first started, I thought, how am I going to find enough people to help me? And now having 61 staff members is incredible. So.
You have 61 staff in this. It's a small shop.
Mm-hmm. Well, we rotate a lot. They're not all here at the exact same time. But I have 18 bakers in the kitchen. I have 3 savory chefs, and I have three general managers. I've got 2 event planners. So it's a lot, but it's really incredible.
Did you envision that scope when you started?
God, no. No, in my business plan, I had 8 people, and I thought, oh my gosh, how am I gonna make enough food to pay 8 people? So, no, it's gone above and beyond my expectations. So
tell me about what it was like when you first opened. You know, we walked through the building then, and you talked about how you had remodeled a cottage here in Broad Ripple. What was it like when you first opened?
Well, when I first opened, I had a lot of people tell me that I should throw an event and tell everyone that I was opening. It was my opening day, and we'd have a grand opening party. And I didn't want to spend the money on that because I didn't have any. So all I did was turn the sign. And the minute I turned the sign, we had a line out the door, and people would wrap around the counter. And we originally started as counter service because I didn't think people were going to like it. I really didn't. I didn't know what to expect. And so we ended up getting so busy that after having counter service, people would order a piece of cake and we couldn't find them because there were so many people in here. We didn't know where they went. So it's like, okay, now we have to give people numbers. So then we tried that, and that didn't really work because then we couldn't see the numbers because there was too many things on the tables. And so then we're in full swing of waiter service, and we have hostesses every day, and we have reservations online. And so we have evolved like a ton since we first opened. It just has grown into something I never expected.
So when you first opened, it was November, right? Of 2 years ago. And you opened, decorated for Christmas, right? And here we are again, beautifully decorated for Christmas. And it is it's magical and gorgeous and sparkly. Tell me what the vision was for Cake Bake Shop.
Well, when I first started, my vision was just to really be like I said before, to make an extension of my home, and it would be a place where people could come in and I could be making the recipes that I've been making for over 30 years. But now I just get to share it with a wider audience. And that was originally my vision. I just wanted it to be really beautiful. I wanted it to be a place where you could come and eat a dessert and have a glass of wine or champagne and not feel like you had to sit in your car. That's kind of how I started. When I would go to Taylor's, I would buy a little donut holes and I'd sit in my car and I'd eat them. And I'm like, I'm not a closet eater, but I don't have a place to go. And so I wanted to make a place for people to come, you know, that would have a fireplace and it would be warm and cozy and inviting. And you'd want to come and hang out with your friends.
Now, how did you make that happen? I mean, you're a busy career person. You know, you have kids, you have a family. How did you do it?
I didn't see my kids for 2 years, basically. I would leave and they would be asleep. Thank God my husband was not working at the time, so he could stay home and take care of the boys. But I literally would leave when they were sleeping, and I would come home and they would be asleep. So I would miss their entire day. But they knew where I was, so I was only maybe a mile from home. So if they wanted to see me, they could come here. But I really never was home very much for the first 2 years. So it's really nice that I've hit that 2-year mark, because now I have a little bit more free time. I don't have a lot, but at least I get to take them to school now, so that's good. And I pick them up. So,
now, tell me what a day is like here at the Cake Bake Shop for you.
For me? Well, I'll give you an example of today. I got here at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I'm reteaching some girls how to make pie dough because we have Thanksgiving coming, and we have a lot of pie orders that we have to fulfill. So I came in at 5. We did like a little pie dough making course. And then I went home and I woke up my children and I drove them to school. And then I came back to the shop and we continued to make pie dough. And we made a couple of fillings for pies. And then I had a meeting come in. So I had to meet with them. And now you're here. And so then I'm going to go and we're having a wonderful time. And I'm forcing you to eat all kinds of desserts, which I love. And then I'm going back into the kitchen to make more pies for the rest of the day. And then I'll pick up my kids later. Yeah, and I won't make dinner because I don't have time. So, I'll get them Chipotle, I guess. So that's my day, basically, and it continues. So usually I don't know if it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday because they all blend into me. Next thing I know, it's Christmas. Next thing I know, it's spring break. I'm like, wow, time flies. So
now you must be always thinking about the shop and new items and new things to make. I'm sure that that's constantly going through your head.
Always going through my mind. We change our menu every 3 months. So every 3 month period, we will rotate all of our cake flavors for the season. I have certain cakes that I used to take off the menu, but when I would take them off, people would get really upset. So they're like, that's my favorite cake. You can't take that off the menu. So now we have 7 cakes constantly that we always have. And then I rotate 5 more cakes every couple of months. So right now we have our caramel popcorn cake. We have all of our fall items. We have our pumpkin ginger cake. So in December, on the 1st, we're going to switch it over to chocolate peppermint and all kinds of yummy holiday treats. Well, our eggnog cheesecake that we bring out. We have a beautiful coconut cake that we make for Christmas. So it's nice because it keeps it interesting and it keeps it changing so that you always want to come back. And then I always am changing the decorations. And I do that for the season also. So I'm kind of like Disney in a way that on Halloween night, I was up for 18 hours and we take down all the Halloween decorations and you wake up the next morning and all of a sudden it's Christmas here. So, and this will stay up until spring. And then I have a whole new plan of decor for spring. So yes, I'm constantly thinking about what I'm going to do next.
Now, all of the recipes and the cakes, the pies, the cookies, are these things that you created over the years, is that right?
They've been recipes that I've been making for over 30 years. And when I first started, I have a huge book full of tear sheets from magazines. I think I was one of Bon Appetit's first subscribers when they first started. And I have hundreds of recipes that I have, you know, spills on and notes. I would always change them a little bit to tweak them if I didn't like it at too much salt or if I thought it had too much sugar. And so those are the recipes that we're making today. Every single thing that we serve here is something that I've made in the past. Yeah.
Now, I think you told me a couple of years ago when you first opened that, you know, you had you know, taken cakes to school for so many years and given teacher presents and that sort of thing. Tell me how did that sort of developed, how you polished these recipes and cooked over the years?
Well, I started that actually because when I moved here, I was 43 and I had to start over because I didn't know anyone. I had no friends. I didn't know, you know, I figured one day I'll learn all the names of all the people that are at school. And the way for me to do that was to make food and bring it to different people's homes. And that's how I got to know people. That was kind of my way of trying to get myself to be comfortable and introduce myself. Like, hi, here I am. I have a pie. And so that's kind of how I started, at least here in Indianapolis.
Now, your husband is from here, but you weren't. Is that right?
That's correct. He grew up here, was born here and grew up here and went to Park Tudor. And we moved here to be closer to his family and to be close to his mom and his sister. And so our boys could go to the same school that he went to, give him a better education. So that's why we moved here.
Now, but it must not have been, I mean, it was probably a financial challenge to open this vision that you had. So it wasn't easy, was it?
No, God, no, absolutely not. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done, actually. Just to find a place that I thought that I could open up into was going to cost me money that I didn't have. And I knew that in the vision that I wanted to create, that I was going to have to get a loan from somewhere because my husband and I don't have a lot of money. And I went to 5 different banks to try to get loans, and they all said no. And every meeting that I went to, of course, I brought either cupcakes or I brought cakes or I brought desserts, and they would eat them. And they're like, this is delicious. Have you ever opened up a restaurant before? I said, no. Well, do you have $300,000? I was like, no. If I had that, I wouldn't be here. And they all said no. So it was really, that was the hardest challenge. That every morning I would wake up, I was like, you know what, I can't give up now because I already gave up my oldest son's college fund and I gave up my second child's college fund. I thought, I am so far in it financially that I can't turn back. And I went to one more bank, and that was First Merchants Bank, and they said yes. And if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be here.
Oh my goodness. Now what a story. So you put those savings into the business. That was a risk.
Well, it was, because my husband was either going to leave me and we were going to go bankrupt, or I was going to wake up every single day at 4 in the morning and I was going to bake something and I was going to make it work. And I did. Thank God. Thank God I made it work.
We've been talking with Gwendolyn Rogers of the Cake Bake Shop in Broad Ripple. For more information, go to thecakebakeshop.com or look for it on Facebook.
such an inspiring time of year for cooks. Well, okay, I know it really isn't spring yet, but with the occasional warm weather we've had so far, I just can't help looking ahead. And I love to hear about what inspires other cooks, especially when it comes to springtime ingredients. You know, ramps, morels, asparagus, rhubarb, they're all favorites, and I know we can't wait for them to appear at the markets. Last spring, I talked with local chef Tyler Harold, executive chef for Patachou, Petit Chou, Napolis, and Public Greens, about fresh ingredients and working closely with local farmers. Their dedication to raising the best produce possible inspires him, and that affects the way he and his staff look at their ingredients. Now, fresh greens are often available, even in winter months, but I talked with Tyler about the excitement that comes with those first text messages from farmers and the first deliveries of even something simple like radishes.
Do you get excited about these first ingredients, you know, the foraged ramps and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, ramps are always that's sort of the first thing, and that's always, to me, like, one of the signs of spring. And then radishes. Like, radishes are generally the first, like, cultivated, that and the greens, you know. I mean, I love it all, but you sort of, you know, the greens can only go so far. I mean, you know, like, yeah, it's kale and spinach and arugula and chard and, you know, but the first time you actually get, like, a radish, you know, an actual, like, something that's not just a leaf, you're like, okay.
Something solid and round and red, for heaven's sakes, it's red, you know?
Exactly, yeah, that's when it's like, okay, now, you know, we're kind of back to, you know, back to the fun stuff.
How does that inspire you as far as your food and the dishes you create?
I mean, for me, it's 1,000,000%, 100%. You know, all the menus I do are seasonal. I think it's, you know, not only do you know, people always ask, or, you know, people ask about my cooking style or whatever. And, you know, a lot of times I'll just let, you know, I sort of tend to think that, you know, I let the ingredients just shine for themselves. And I think, you know, when you start with good ingredients, it doesn't take much. You know, it doesn't take a lot of sauces and crazy spices. I also think, you know, for me, cooking seasonally, you know, it does a service to, you know, the farmers and the other people that are, you know, that are working hard to bring us this stuff.
Now, you work with lots of farmers, probably, you know, maybe more so than most other chefs.
Yep.
What's that like, and how does that influence how you cook?
It all boils down to communication. You know, it's a lot of communication back and forth between myself and them. You know, at the very beginning, you know, meetings in the winter months about, you know, what to grow, how to grow it, you know, how much to grow it, you know, what can they sort of count on me or us to buy, you know, to grow that kind of stuff. And, you know, then once you sort of get into it, it's just a lot of back and forth communication. We had, you know, just already Monday, Silverthorn, Nate Parks sent me a text and said, hey, I've got spinach, arugula, radishes. I said, okay. Went a couple hours, talked, you know, decide what I wanted. I said, okay, bring me the radishes. A little bit later, he texted me and said, actually, I went out and checked on the radishes. Because of the wind on Saturday, it blew the tops off the hoop houses. So he basically lost all the radishes. So, I mean, it's a lot of that sort of thing, you know, weather and bugs and God knows whatever else, deer coming and eating heads of lettuce and you know, whatever else.
So you have to, you know, adjust, you know, so you're probably constantly adjusting what you're thinking about.
Exactly. And you know, I adjust with them and they adjust with me. If we get, you know, if I get a catering, you know, that pops up and I'm like, okay, well, now we need 75 spinach salads. Like, okay, hey, I told you earlier, like, I wanted 10 pounds. Now I need 15 pounds. You know, can you do that or can you make that happen? And that, you know, it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of, you know, not just picking up the phone and calling a produce company that you can call until 12 o'clock at night, and then they show up the next day with this perfect box of whatever, and here you go. Actually, it's not always perfect, but in a box, at least.
So that must be a lot of extra work for you, just as you create each menu.
Not even so much, even more so, not just a menu, but just a day to day. And I mean, I don't know if that's cliche to say, but I mean, I think it's worth it. I think it's, I talk to a lot of farmers. I talk to a lot of different, sort of people who ask about this and ask, like, well, how do you do it, or why do you do it, or what's the, and I think, it really boils down to two things. One, because of the support from Martha and her never wavering on price, to her, she wants the best possible products we can get. So I have that luxury to be able to do that, and also the buying power of 10 restaurants. And to me, it's a lot about the personal relationships that you develop with those farmers, and knowing their names and their kids' names and their pets' names and their children's names and their background, and and salespeople are the same way, don't get me wrong, but it makes it more real when you sort of know them and have been to their farm and seen how they do it. And they pull up in a beat up truck and they still have their overalls on or whatever. I probably shouldn't say this out loud, but we work really long hours in the restaurant industry, and you're always on your feet, and it's hard, and it's hot, and it's sweaty, and it's nasty sometimes. And farming is a lot alike, so you sort of relate to them.
Well, sure. So there's a kinship there, and I'm sure, because you're taking their products that they have, cared for all along the way, and then you're doing something wonderful with them. So that must be a nice thing too.
It is. It totally is. And that's something that I sort of, when I get new cooks, I will sort of, it's sort of my little like circle of life thing. I want them to know that, this starts way back in, November, December. There's a meeting, and then we talk about what we're going to get, and then, they have to order seeds, and then they have to get the seeds, and then they have to plant the seeds, and then they have to transplant the seeds, and then they have to weed the seeds and water the seeds, and the weather has to all be perfect, and the deer have to not come in there, and the raccoons don't have to come in there, and then they have to pick it, and then they have to wash it, and then they have to box it, and then I have to text them and say what I want, and they have to text me, I got it. Then they drive it to us. Then we get it. And
so that's a process.
It's a huge process, and I want every single person that works for us to know that every time that you maybe forget about something and it goes bad, or every time that we eat a box of tomatoes and you just kind of throw it, you don't store it right, you don't store it correctly, and we lose something, you didn't just lose a tomato or whatever. Think about all the hours and the work and the time that went into that, whatever it may be.
We've been talking with Chef Tyler Harold at Public Greens in Broad Ripple. For more information on the Urban Kitchen with a Mission, go to publicgreensurbankitchen.com.
Warm spring weather is drawing everyone outdoors, and I just know some of you are thinking about cooking out. It's definitely time to get the barbecue grill ready for summer if you haven't already. But some of you may be thinking that, those ribs you make on the grill are pretty good, and maybe you should go pro. Well, for anyone out there interested in competitive barbecue, Indy's own Jeff Yater of Squealer's Barbecue gives us the scoop today on cooking for competition. I sat down with Jeff recently to get a little inside information on what competitive barbecue is all about.
There's a lot of things that go into it. So not only is the people that you meet on the road and having fun with them and learning things from them, but it's also, if you have a competitive nature, obviously it's going to be a good sport for you to go into. Judges have a very big control. Everybody's opinion's different. Flavor profiles are different. For me, competition barbecue is trying to pick the best quality meats that we can, getting a dry rub and a sauce and your flavor layers just right to hit all elements that you're trying to hit. Be it like for us, you know, usually we like to start with a little bit of sweet in the front side of it. And in the back side, as you're swallowing, basically you're going to get a little heat. Not a lot of heat, but for us, it's not all just about sweetness. So we want multiple flavor layers in our competition.
Now, how do you figure all that out? Kind of tell me the backstory about how you got into this and how it progressed to where you are now.
Well, I got into it a little over 20 years ago, and my dad got me into it, and Ron Yater, and we just did it for fun. It was classic, a hobby, right? And we did
to start out from a backyard thing?
Yeah, from a backyard thing, basically. We know did a lot of cooking at home, this and kind of things. And first contest was at Deer Creek way back when in the early 90s. And it was just a rib contest. So we cooked ribs, and we kind of got the bug there. Can't really recall. I think we got second or third at that contest out of 9 teams. So it wasn't.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah, for your first one, we were proud. And then that year also the World Pork Expo was in town. So we did that down at the fairgrounds. And there was, I don't know, around 60 teams there that year probably. And we ended up taking like 9th in ribs. And that's the only thing we cooked out of the 4 categories because we only had a little tiny cooker.
But well, no, that's the thing. Sometimes at the contests, you know, you see great big rigs and everything. But then sometimes you see just little grills and cookers and things like that. So you started out small then.
Yeah, real small. I mean, went from that. That was just a dome type cooker that we were cooking on then. We got a little larger. When was it? 2000 or 99, I think. My dad ended up winning the World Pork Expo. So that's where we ended up. He started with a bigger rig then because they gave one away. So now he had one on wheels, which back then most of your competition teams didn't have large setups. They didn't have RVs. They didn't have toy haulers. They had 10x10 tents and cots and small cookers, you know. The profiles changed so much over the years. It started, you could have a decent dry rub, a decent sauce, and you should do decently at the contest. You know, where it's evolved to now is I would say the RVs and pull behinds are more prevalent than your 10x10 tents nowadays. There's not many people just dry rubbing. There's a lot of injecting going on. There's a lot of different layer profiles that you're doing on your meats. You know, you really only have about a 24-hour window to do anything with anyway. So it's evolved to be, I kind of relate it to where NASCAR was years ago and to where it is now. And I know it's nearly not that large, but, I mean, you have contests out there paying $50,000. You have contests out there paying $20,000. I mean, so there's some large contests out there that pay big money. And when you start getting into big money, you get into people have they're very closed mouth about what they do. It's kind of like your playlist. You know, you're not going to tell people your playlist. We do have a group of friends that we're all pretty tight. They all do pretty well. We'll bounce a little bit of recipes off each other. But no one gives the 100% out there. I can tell you that. So it
has become a very big deal. You know, with, like you said, with the big RVs, the big rigs, the secrecy on the ingredients.
Right.
So when did that happen?
I think it's evolved over the years. You start seeing a lot more larger trailers. When I got involved in about 1999, I built my first trailer. But I was doing a rib fest circuit, so I needed something large. It's more like a kitchen. So I put a big smoker in that. I had a sink system. I had refrigeration in it. So that was about the start of where people started building bigger things to do competitions on. And through the last 15 years, you've just seen it grow more and more and more, and people getting bigger and bigger. And you know, it's not necessarily it makes you cook better, but it makes it more comfortable to be there for 3 days while you're doing it. So
some of them are multi-day events, and you are there. I mean, you're tending to the whatever you have on the cookers. You know, you're sleeping there. You know, you're there all day. What's one of those events like?
Well, we usually roll in on a Thursday, depending on where we're pulling to. It's usually on a Thursday afternoon. On Friday morning, you can get your meat inspected at most of the contests. And you have to have that meat inspected in order to use it. It can't come in pre-marinated, pre-rubbed. It has to be.
It's just a plain piece of meat.
Right, raw product. So, and you know, we have chicken, pork shoulders, ribs and beef brisket are usually the main four categories. So we usually pull in on Thursday afternoon. We get set up. We get the trailer ready, get organized. Friday morning, we're usually hitting. As soon as we get our meat inspected, we're working on trimming it and injecting it. And you can trim your meat before you get to a contest, but we're usually not that organized to get that done before we go. So we're usually doing that on Friday morning. That's about, a 4-hour process to get everything done. Once we have it trimmed, then we start our injection processes. We start our rub processes. And then after all that's done, Friday is more of a social day. You kind of watch people roll in, talk to people you haven't seen in a long time, kind of figure out if you're changing stuff up on your game plan, you know, rubs, sauces, you kind of work with those a little bit. Sometimes on Friday we might do a sample cook of some chicken or something along those lines. But our competition usually starts with the meat throwing on about 10 o'clock at night on Friday night.
Oh, so. My goodness. So that for a Saturday event, right?
Yeah, we're a low and slow cook. There's teams out there that cook hot and fast, it's called, which they're cooking at a higher temperature, obviously, and it's a shorter process. For us, we're still about a 225 to 250-degree cooker. We run those. Our pork butts will go on at, like I said, around 10 o'clock at night, and those aren't actually turned in until usually around noon the next day, 12:30 the next day. So we run with those. The next piece of meat that we'll throw on is our brisket, and that usually hits about 2 o'clock in the morning. Then.
So you are up all night tending to this.
Yeah, and we have a crew of three. We have Brent Coons, Jim Coldren, and myself, Jeff Yater. And, you know, that's our team that we run with on a normal – we all have our roles, let's say. You know, Coonsy, as we call him, he's usually our middle-of-the-night guy. He likes to – I necessarily doesn't maybe not like it, but he's usually the one that's getting up and stirring the fire up a little bit in the middle of the night. But, yeah, it's an all-night process for us. I mean, we start, and one of the cookers that we deal with, it's not like a pellet cooker or anything like that. So it's something that you have to tend to, and you have to make sure your temperatures aren't spiking or dropping or whatever. So, yeah, it's an all-night event for us. And hopefully the next day everything's coming off right when you want it. We're not much of resters. There's a lot of teams out there. What they'll do is, like, on their bigger pieces of meat, they'll pull them and rest them for a couple hours before they actually turned in. We don't really do that too much. It's just something that – being that I've done this so long, you just kind of get in the old school ways of doing things and how things have evolved with, like, hot and fast cookers and things like that. It's just hard for me to wrap my mind around doing that just because everything I've been taught for so many years is so low and slow.
You mentioned, you know, you watching the people come in then, you know, the night before. It seems like it's a real community, right?
Oh, yeah. I've met I don't know how many friends through the barbecue world. I mean, not only are we local and we do local barbecue with the restaurants, but over the years of knowing people and seeing how many people have taken a hobby such as myself to a business level. You know, I mean, I know guys that one guy, Ray Lampe, which is he's the big green egg rep. First time we met Ray was in Michigan. He was sitting Indian style cooking on a hibachi. So, you know, he's come a long way from then. And, you know, Byron, Bad Byron, which owns Butt Rub, you know, he started when I started way back when. And now he has, you know, a seasoning and spice company, you know. So there's a lot of people that have taken this competition barbecue to the next level.
We've been talking with Jeff Yater of Squealer's Barbecue in Indianapolis. Stay with us for more from Jeff here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. This is Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio talking today with restaurant owner and professional barbecue team member Jeff Yater of Squealer's Barbecue. Now, professional barbecue has become a huge thing, and Jeff has been a part of competitions all over the country. He tells us what the events are like for participants and fans, and offers a little advice for anyone thinking about entering a contest. If somebody wanted to go, what would they see?
They're all different. I mean, some of them have things that are go along with it. Like I mentioned in Liberty, there'll be a car show there. There'll be vendors there that they can buy some stuff, you know. Probably the best contest, in my personal opinion, in the state as far as crowd involvement would be Madison, Indiana, and that's in August. And they've just done a terrific job at that contest. It's been going on. I think this is going to be the 14th or 15th year, and we've been – now, I said I'd backed off the competition road. I've been to Madison every year but the first year that they started. So,
oh, my gosh. So that must be a favorite.
Yeah, that's more of a – it's a big contest, okay? And usually you don't do very well at contests if you're only doing one a year. So, you know, but we got to see a lot of our friends that come into that state for that contest, and it is a favorite contest. The organizers are great. You know, we got honored last year for being one of two teams that have been there that long,
Oh my God.
So that's a staple for us. But we've traveled all over the country. I try to focus on the state of Indiana now, but 4 years ago we were in Vegas cooking. So, I mean, it's, you know, that year I was going for big contests. I wanted to really see what we could do, and never drove to Vegas. So we loaded up the RV, and it was a family affair, and, you know, my mom and dad and Jim and I went and drove all the way across the country. So that wasn't a very good trip for us, though. There was a lot of teams there. The best we scored was 50th place in one category, which they called top 50. That's how big the contest was. So we were lucky enough to get our name called, but not really too proud of it, you know. but the most of the contests, family-friendly, you know, competitors are usually – fairly friendly. I mean,
yeah, that was my question. Can like just the casual observer, you know, talk to the contestants? Are they, you know, willing to chit chat?
Yeah, most of them. You know, there's just a few out there that keep to themselves, but most of us are pretty open with what we do and how we do it. We'll show them the cookers, we'll show them the trailers, you know, give them a little education on how we do it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, over the years, we've met people that come up, they hang out. The only times it gets a little short, Saturday morning isn't a good time to come around and talk to people, and Friday morning, not really, because Friday morning you're doing all your prep work, and that's a long process. And Saturday morning, obviously, it's all about getting the product to the box and getting, yeah, I mean, everything. We've got half-hour windows. Usually it starts at, a you know, 11 or 11:30 turn-in, and every half hour you're turning something else in. And when you're dealing with piece of meats that take 14 hours to cook, there's a skill level to getting it off that cooker at the right time, you know, and getting it in the box to be the best product that you can possibly be, you know. But the flavor profiles switch out. I mean, 4 years ago, we had pork and ribs that were killing it. I mean, we were scoring great in those. Didn't change anything. They've kind of fallen off. Brisket is probably our best category right now, which, you know, our sponsors, the pork producers and Indiana Kitchen, I'm sorry that brisket's our best product right now, but it is. We're working on the others. So,
I'm kind of interested in the progression from backyard barbecuer to competitor to owning a restaurant. Is that a common progression? You know, and how did it work for you?
Well, there wasn't much backyard back then. You know, I mean, it was just a professional sport. Like I had mentioned, the first one we did, I would call that a backyard event. But those were few and far between, that kind of thing. You know, the World Pork Expo, that's by far not a backyard event. That's huge. Yeah. And then backyards really started coming on scene more, say, 4 or 5 years ago, where they would have multiple events. They'd have a professional event, and they also would have a backyard event.
So like the amateur category.
Right, yeah. And, you know, we've taken two different teams that we've kind of mentored over the last 4 or 5 years and helped them along with we've got to know them in the backyard because, you know, we stroll through there and we're talkers, you know. So so we've taken a couple teams and we've started mentoring them. We're trying to talk one of them that we've been mentoring to jump to the professional side. But I don't know if they're really ready to do that. And they had some setbacks last year, but, they're going to be back on the road again this year at a few of the events. So we'll get to catch back up with them and see where they're at. But that's always fun. I mean, to me, I'll give those guys pretty much as I can to help them win, you know, show them the ways of how to do well. You know, some competitors will say, oh, we're a lot better than Squealers, and some are, you know, competing. But for us, it went from the backyard to a competition professional level. And like I mentioned earlier, my first really business venture was into the rib fest industry. And so we would do the Marat downtown back in the day, and then now it's in Military Park, which it's an event that right now is kind of hit and miss if it's going to be around or not. But they have multiple of those all around the country, and that's how.
So you started out doing that?
Yeah, that's the progression to the business. Originally was the Rib Fest team, and I did biggest year I did was 23 different cities in one summer. So I was gone a lot and sometimes not home for 3 weeks at a time, you know. So we'd have ribs shipped into the city that we were in. I mean, you know, it wasn't like we were hauling everything with us. So they'd bring in big meat trucks to these events and they unload to you. But I did that about 2 years. Then my daughter, she was born, and I needed to stay around the house a little bit more. So that's when I took the big jump into the restaurant business. And we opened Mooresville in 2001, and I had 9 employees. I managed from my cook's line. I did pretty much everything I had to do, you know, worked 100-hour weeks, those fun times like that. And then over the course of the years, we opened West 86th Street off of Zionsville Road and 86th Street in 2004. And then we opened this Castleton location here last year in April. So over the progression of opening more restaurants, I mean, challenge hasn't gotten any easier, I can tell you that. One thing, we run with about 140 to 150 employees now, so we do employ a lot of people. And we try to keep their employment there, you know. So that's kind of how it's changed for me.
We've been talking with Jeff Yater of Squealer's Barbecue in Indianapolis and Mooresville. For more information on the restaurants and the barbecue competitions, go to squealerbarbecue.com. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thanks so much for tuning into our show this week, and thanks also to our guests, Chef Tom England of Ivy Tech Community College, Suzanne Krowiak of Indie Food Swappers, Gwendolyn Rogers of The Cake Bake Shop, Chef Tyler Harold of Patashew Inc., and barbecue champ Jeff Yater of Squealer's Barbecue. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio.